This is Warbird Radio. Now showing on aerocinema.com.
If anyone had said you're going to get involved in auto charas, I'd have said that straight windmill thing. No. As soon as I got the eyesight test, the doctor said, what if you'd never be able to land an aeroplane? I made suicidal pass after pass trying to get the thing down. And after several times doing this thing, with no fuel showing on the gauges, I called up and said, couldn't the crew bail out? There's no sense in them staying with me while I was trying to do it. And all the time we were flying, we had an atom bomb on board. And when we were in a certain area of the North Pole from Canada, if we got the message, we had a target to attack in Russia. People say, why do you have so many? My answer is, it's like having a harem of girls or women. They're all the same basic design, but they kind of differ in nature. I remember when I landed, and Covey of Broccoli was looking at me from a distance. He said, yeah, same build, he'll do. Meaning I was the same build as Sean Connery.
The Logbook Series, featuring Ken Wallace, now showing on aerocinema.com.
St. Adams here from the Wednesday Night Wix Show, here to tell you about the new aviation t-shirts available now at warbirdradio.com/deals. Click on the Wright Brothers catalog link. There are lots of great t-shirts to choose from, like the classic World War II Flying Tigers, Tuskegee Airmen, and the ever-popular P-51 Mustang, as well as many other fun aviation designs. Talk to you next Wednesday evening on the Wix Warbird Weekly Live Show, and hopefully you'll be listening wearing your new Aero-style t-shirt. Visit warbirdradio.com/deals now and check out the all-new Wright Brothers catalog.
Hi, this is Mike Chilson, host of the RC Scale Builder Show here on Warbird Radio. If you're interested in scale models, join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern for interviews and the latest news and events in RC Scale. The RC Scale Builder Show here on Warbird Radio.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
And welcome here to Warbird Radio. Matt Jolly here with you. Having a good week so far. I'll tell you what, we are just back from the McConnell Air Force Base Air Show. And before that, we were at NRV Skyfest in Virginia, up there in Dublin, Virginia. But McConnell Air Force Base, boy, oh boy, can they put on a show. Thunderbirds were there. The home team was there with the KC-135. And, of course, you know, Learjet is right there in Wichita, Kansas, and of course they brought over a wonderful airplane, as well as folks from Beechcraft bringing over the T-6-2. So we had a great show down there, and Thunderbirds did a wonderful job. The CAF, friends of the show here, did a terrific job. They brought over a P-40 and the Tuskegee Airmen P-51C from Rise Above was there as well. Can't say enough good things about our friends at the Commemorative Air Force. If you're not already a member, please sign up today and put down Warbird Radio in the box. You know, if you love these airplanes, if you love seeing them fly, the Commemorative Air Force, the best organization nationwide, worldwide, really, preserving and flying the World War II airplanes that we know and love. There's a lot of other ones, there's a lot of other friends of the station, but the Commemorative Air Force, certainly the one that is in the lead when it comes to sheer numbers. Over 8,000 members right now. And they'd love to have you as one. So please, put your money where your mouth is and sign up today. Become a colonel in the Commemorative Air Force. And take pride in the fact that that your money is going to, keeping airplanes like the SB-2C Helldiver in the air. The only one in the air that's still flying. The only B-29 in the world still flying. So good stuff with our friends at the Commemorative Air Force. You can sign up right now. Just run a search for Commemorative Air Force. They're in Google, and it'll pull right up their website, Will, CAF site, and sign up today, become a member. Also, Wings Over Houston, just a few weeks away, as well as the Alliance Air Show in Fort Worth going on this weekend, and then they were there at homecoming for the CAF in Midland, Texas, just a few weeks away as well. So lots going on in the air show season. as we kind of wrap things up here. I've been out on the road doing some announcing, having a great time doing that, and enjoyed seeing a lot of you. But the big ones are still to come for us. The CAF Air Show, Wings Over Houston, 2 mega Warbird events. And we'd love to hear from you if you're going to make it out there. My guest this week is none other than the author Dan King. He is the author of a book that has truly had my attention ever since this came out. We're talking about The Last Zero Fighter, and Dan is joining us now from California. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for coming on. It's a pleasure to finally meet you over the phone.
And, thanks for having me.
Well, listen, I want to kind of paint the picture here. You were the son of a B-29 gunner from Korea. And your dad was on a B-29 over there. So I guess the aircraft that flew in World War II were sort of always something of your fancy. They sort of always were interested in this. Mm-hmm. But here's the interesting part about this. You know how to speak Japanese. You actually worked for Toyota. You lived in Japan. Yeah. So you're over there, and you're thinking, well, man, what can I do that hasn't been done yet? You're an author. So you wrote a book on Japanese military sake cups, and then you said, you know what? Enough with the sake cups. Let's dive in and learn about the Zero. And now we have this wonderful first-hand account of Zero fighter pilots, thanks to you. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Let's talk about the book. What gave you the idea? What sparked this interest in, and how did you go about talking to these guys? I'm just curious. You don't just show up. I'm guessing the fact that you speak Japanese probably greatly helped your cause.
Well, I think that's something that no one has been able to do before, because you need to be able to read, write, and speak their language in order to communicate with them, you know, through letters, to read their memoirs, to talk to them in person. And you have to know the historical background, the technical jargon that they use. I think that if you try to approach like a Japanese veteran and say, please tell me your story, let's say, for example, you have a translator who might not know the technical terms or the military jargon or the historical background, the interview kind of like stutters and stops and doesn't go very well.
Hmm.
But that was something that I really wanted to do. When I was a youngster, I loved history, and I was surprised that there was almost nothing from the Japanese point of view to read. And when I was in junior high and high school, there was really nothing. And I wound up living in Japan for 10 years, and I often met these veterans through friends, coworkers, you know, family members. I started recording their stories. I thought one thing that struck me over and over and over was that these guys were no different than our people in the things they said about training, friends, combat, working with, you know, their superior officers who were sometimes good, sometimes bad, and the feeling towards their enemy. And I thought, I want to share this with other people. They have some remarkable stories, experiences.
Well, let's talk about some of these gentlemen. I guess, is it Mr. Harada that is one of the guys that that you interviewed? This gentleman was at Wake Island, flew off the Soryu. I mean, this is incredible history from the other side that we seldom hear about. Talk to us about Mr. Harada there.
Well, Harada-san is very unique in that he is the last surviving airman who took part in the USS Panay raid in December 1937 outside of Nanking. And that was an event that almost started World War II 4 years early.
Hmm.
You know, and I talked to him about that event, and I asked him a lot of questions that he answered very honestly and very frankly about why they attacked the Panay and what they were thinking, and his, you know, his superiors' decision to attack the Panay. And I was just amazed that this had not been published in the U.S. before.
Well, give us some of those reasons. I think there's a lot of people that are hearing this now for the first time. They say, "Well, why? You know, why did they attack the Panay? I mean, that seems like a pretty risky move for at that time the nation of Japan to attack a U.S. warship."
Well, you know, there's a lot of conflict going on in China at that time between not only the U.S. but, you know, England and the Japan and Russia, and there was, you know, everyone was trying to grab a big piece of the pie over there in China, and. You know, what happened was the Panay was a riverboat out there, kind of patrolling the Yangtze River, providing security for missionaries and businessmen, and they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. When the Japanese pushed the Chinese army back up towards Nanking, the capital of China, and they kind of, like, caught the cat in the bag, so to speak, and the Panay was escorting government officials and Americans, businessmen and missionaries away from the state towards freedom. And according to Mr. Harada, it was the Japanese army that issued orders for the Japanese Navy to attack the Panay and the vessel she was escorting.
Well, that's interesting. An interesting take on a piece of history there that is seldom discussed here in the U.S. and really seldom discussed anywhere else. But, you know, it seems like the winners always write the history, as you said. I know a number of authors have said that. And so here we have a U.S. citizen writing the history as accurately as possible for the other side. And Mr. Harada, just one of those gentlemen, later went on to train the kamikaze pilots. Who were slated to fly the Cherry Blossom and other rocket-powered airplanes. Mm-hmm. What did he say about that? I'm sure the kamikaze strategy is so unique and so foreign to most Westerners. What was his thought and his takeaway on that?
You know, there's something that I got from all of the pilots who either escorted kamikazes, taught kamikazes, or went out on kamikaze missions of their own. And the thing that struck me was they were not motivated by so much as hatred or anger towards us, but they're motivated by trying to protect their families, trying to protect their homeland, and in doing what they're told to do in their duty, and doing what everyone else is doing.
Hmm.
And that group mentality, as you know, I've never been in the military, but I know that in the military, the group mentality is very strong, and a devotion to duty. Especially in World War II Japan, where they're trained from childhood that the nation is more important than self. And it's even in their code, their military code of conduct called Senjin-kun, where they were not permitted to suffer the shame of becoming a prisoner. And it was better to kill oneself than become a prisoner.
Hmm.
So the thought of letting the entire nation, quote, become a prisoner was unthinkable. And so when it came down to the Americans have more materials, more gas, more ships, more bombs, more pilots, planes, what do we have left? We have almost nothing left to fight with. So these guys threw themselves at us. And it's not a good correlation, but like the people who are mad at us today, in today's world, seem to hate us at a core. They hate our freedoms, our liberties, the way we live our lives. They hate us. But the impression I got from the Japanese former pilots that I interviewed was that they didn't hate us at the time. They were doing their duty to protect the country and doing their duty as naval airmen as they were trained. But I didn't get a feeling of hatred from any of them at all.
That's an interesting perspective. And, of course, the kamikaze pilots, as you pointed out, simply doing their duty to protect their nation. And that's there's a big difference in that when you say that they didn't want them to suffer the shame of being a prisoner, that it was better to take one's life than suffer that shame. A real difference in the Western culture where life is valued really above everything. I mean, it's do what you have to do to survive and come back home. Really sort of the mindset. Don't give anything away, but do what you have to do to survive. And a far cry there from that of the Japanese. What did they think? I'm curious about Mr. Harada's impression of some of the aircraft later on in the war. We're talking about the Zero, but clearly there were other airplanes, like the George and other airplanes that they flew that were supreme fighting machines, much more well-equipped than the Zero. What was their take on the airplanes that they were flying back then?
Well, Mr. Harada always flew the Zero, but Mr. Miyazaki, another of the veterans in the book, he flew the George on the Chidenkai, and he loved it. He really loved it. He was with the 343, the famous air group that was commanded by Minoru Genda, who was the planner of the Pearl Harbor attack.
Right.
And he flew the Chidenkai, and he loved the way the power, the maneuverability, and he loved the armor, and he just really enjoyed flying it. He did make a comment saying that he wishes he would have had 50 calibers instead of the 20 millimeters in the wings.
Hmm.
I knew that from two other pilots as well, is that they really liked the American 50 caliber because of the range and the volume of fire.
Well, it was a preferred weapon of choice, but again, the Japanese Navy did not have access to that at that time. Thank God. It might have been a different war. One of the interesting things about Mr. Miyazaki is that he actually witnessed a boxcar flying over the top of Nagasaki ultimately into the war. What was his take on the atomic bomb, the second one that would have dropped on Japan, if he witnessed that?
You know, it is heartbreaking for them. You know, Mr. Kasai witnessed it. He's in the book. Mr. Miyazaki witnessed it. And most recently, we discovered that Mr. Honda Minoru, who's also a pretty famous pilot from the 343, was in the air at the time. He was ferrying a George from the factory down south. And he was in the air and felt the blast. It pushed his plane about 30 feet. And, you know, the gentleman's, their opinions on the atomic bomb were that it was tragic, but it was a necessary part of war. And they all admit that if it were not for the A-bomb, they would have kept fighting until they were all dead.
Yeah.
There was no way to surrender. There was no way out.
You know what it seems like to me? Now, this is my take on this. I've interviewed a lot of these World War II veterans who were slated to go into combat. The plan, you know, as you're well aware, was to invade Japan with a full-on assault if the bomb had not been dropped. And, of course, many of them from the U.S. side say, that, look, had it not been for the atomic bomb, you know, I'd be dead, because they knew what they were going to be up against. It seems to me like everybody who really is or is positioned against the atomic bomb, the folks who really have the hatred, I mean the outright hatred, and most of these are U.S. citizens for the bomb, A, were not there, B, have no relatives who would have been there that they know of. I have heard not one veteran. And now it's interesting that you bring this up from the other side, say, you know, this was not a good idea. This was something we could have done without. We should have just gone on fighting. It certainly saved lives, no matter how you look at it. As gruesome as that weapon was, and that capability still is, it has, and I think it will be forever a deterrent for other nations to go to war. I mean, it certainly did its job, and it was effective, and it saved lives, some estimate in the millions, on both sides. So that's interesting that you bring that point up, that they felt that it was something that indeed stopped the war and saved lives on both sides. You know, we're talking about the Zero. Obviously, this is an airplane that many of these men knew and they loved, probably just like the U.S. pilots loved their P-51s and loved their P-47s. Share some stories with us about the love of this airplane and the men who flew them.
You know, the pilots all started off in these little biplane trainers, you know, when they joined the Naval, they call it the Naval Enlisted Youth Course. It's called the Yokoran. And these are, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old boys who've never driven a car, never operated any kind of machinery, and they want to be pilots. And so they take tests, and they get admitted into this Yokoran Enlisted Aviation Course. They have perfect eyesight, perfect health, perfect teeth, and they're very intelligent. They have to pass strict entrance exam, and while they're in this Yokoran course, they have to study English, Japanese language, Japanese culture, military history, geometry. They have this huge syllabus. It's like a high school class syllabus while they're learning how to fly. And it takes roughly 2.5 years for these boys to go through this Yokoran class. And then they're finally, you know, given rides in this biplane trainer, which they loved. But one of them, Mr. Imaizumi, when he was describing his first flight in this biplane trainer, his eyes lit up, his hands, you know, flailed around, and he was just really excited. And this was almost 80 years ago when this happened. And then as they go through their introductory basic flight training, they finally get to fly in the Zero, you know, that two-seater trainer version. And every one of them said it was just a dream to fly. They just loved the Zero. Mr. Harada said, it felt like it was part of my body. That when I was sitting in the cockpit, that I wasn't in a plane, that I became the plane. It was just responsive and just wonderful. He's very confident to fight. if we came across the wildcats, we would like lick our chops because they were easy to take down.
Well, it was certainly a maneuverable airplane that was feared by many Americans and loved by the Japanese as well. It, with a turning radius, they could just about outperform anything that it would come across.
All right. I heard not one negative thing about the Zero, other than there was no armor.
Hmm.
And so there's no armor for the engine, the fuel tanks, the pilot. It's a kite with machine guns and cannons. And so if you were, you know, if you got on the wrong side of that dogfight, you're in big trouble. But the maneuverability helped a lot of pilots.
You know, I guess the armor plating, the lack of armor plating, there again goes back to the idea that it's better to die for one's country as opposed to, you know, coming back or being taken a prisoner. So the it seems to me, and what I'm hearing is that the value of life was not as high in that culture back then as it was in the U.S. where we thought about armor plating and sacrificed some performance in our aircraft for the ability to have that armor plating.
Well, from what I understand, the Japanese Navy, when they gave their specifications for the contract to design the Zero, they wanted to go so many miles per hour, to have so many types of weapons on it, and have altitude and speed. And the designer said, well, if you want me to meet these specs, I can't have any armor. And they said, we don't care. You have to meet these specs. But the pilots' lives aren't as important. The Japanese have adopted a Confucius attitude from the Chinese, an old Chinese saying that says, duty is heavier than a mountain, and life is lighter than a feather.
Mm.
And it actually means life is lighter than Mount Tai, which is a massive mountain range in China, which is China's tallest, and it's a whole mountain range. And the feather is actually the word goose down. So your duty is heavier than this massive mountain range, holy mountain range in China. But your life is nothing more than a goose down.
Hmm.
So they're taught that, and they're taught that, and that's what you're told from, you know, childhood onward. And so when it comes down to sacrificing your life for your unit, for your squadron, for your country, that comes into play, I think. And there's also the idea of reincarnation that's, you know, in Japan and in Buddhism. And so there isn't a, this is the end of my life, I'm going to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
This is the end of my life. I might be able to go to heaven, or I might come back again. And
Yeah, it's just a paradigm shift from what the Western world has, you know, the lens that we look through. One of the interesting things here that I've been thumbing through, there is a gentleman who actually witnessed the first official kamikaze flight, and also. Eventually became a kamikaze pilot himself. Explain how he's still with us today after that track.
Well, that's Mr. Imaizumi. He was a fighter pilot. He went to Hainan Island, which is just off the coast of Vietnam, where he was providing, you know, air support and escort for tankers carrying oil back and forth to Japan from the Philippines. And then the war situation worsened. He was sent down to the Philippines to become an escort pilot for the kamikaze. And the kamikaze at this time were almost always the youngest pilots with the least amount of training. So they figured, this guy fresh out of the flight school has maybe 100 hours or more. Let's use him first. And they'll use the escort pilots, the guys with slightly more training, or possibly even a lot more training, to lead them to the fleet. Make sure that they get there, and then report on whether they hit or not, and what they hit, and then come back home and submit reports. And Mr. Imaizumi went out on several of these missions, and he said it really broke his heart to see these young guys, who were just barely younger than him, could barely fly in formation sometimes, take them out to, you know, to try to find the U.S. fleet. And many times, they couldn't find them, because the information was old, the weather was bad, or someone made a navigation error, and they just found us in an open ocean. They had to all come back, land, you know, a debrief, and then do it all over again the next morning. He said emotionally, psychologically, it was really hard on everybody. A lot of drinking, a lot of depression.
Hmm.
But they wouldn't openly talk about the feelings to each other. It's kind of like the Japanese military manly this to keep your feelings inside, as the Japanese do in general. They're not like an open, you know, a people. They're more quiet on the feelings.
Isn't that interesting that they're talking about it today? But, you know, back then, this was something that would have been truly taboo to bring up. I mean, but you know that, you know, every one of them was going through it back then.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, Mr. Inaizumi said, nobody wants to die. And when it comes down to it, people just don't want to die. And in the book, he describes some of the kamikaze that, quote, chickened out and in engine trouble. And they turned around and went back. And there's one mission that I'll let the readers go through, which Mr. Inaizumi was sent out on a mission carrying a bomb and told to crash into a U.S. ship. And he made it back alive. But I don't want to spoil the story.
Yeah.
But,
well, and of course, we're talking about your book, The Last Zero Fighter, which is available right there on your website. It's also available on Amazon and wherever books are sold, but you can find it at historicalconsulting.com. And the website, again, is historicalconsulting.com. The Last Zero Fighter is the name of the book, written by our guest, Mr. Dan King. Dan, you've worked on a number of television documentaries and feature films with the likes of Clint Eastwood and so many more. But this is something that still, at the end of the day, is a story that you want folks to know, you want folks to take home and read. When we come back, I hope you can really answer what's at the root of all of this for you and what drives you forward with this. We're going to take a quick break. If you can stay with us, Dan, we'd love to keep you on, and we'll be right back right after this.
This is Warbird Radio.
Now showing on AeroCinema.com.
If anyone had said you're going to get involved in auto charas, I'd have said that straight wind melting. No. As soon as I got the eyesight test, the doctor said, what if you'd never be able to land an aeroplane? Oh. I made suicidal pass after pass trying to get the thing down. And after several times doing this thing, with no fuel showing on the gauges, I called up and said, couldn't the crew bail out? There was no sense in them staying with me while I was trying to do it. And all the time we were flying, we had an atom bomb on board. And when we were in a certain area of the North Pole from Canada, if we got the message, we had a target to attack in Russia. People say, why do you have so many? My answer is, it's like having a harem of girls or women. They're all the same basic design, but they can't half differ in nature. I remember when I landed, a covey of broccoli was looking at me from a distance. He said, yeah, same build, he'll do. Meaning I was the same build as Sean Connery.
The Logbook Series, featuring Ken Wallace, now showing on AeroCinema.com.
St. Adams here from the Wednesday Night Wix Show, here to tell you about the new aviation t-shirts available now at warbirdradio.com/deals. Click on the Wright Brothers catalog link. There are lots of great t-shirts to choose from, like the classic World War II Flying Tigers, Tuskegee Airmen, and the ever-popular P-51 Mustang, as well as many other fun aviation designs. Talk to you next Wednesday evening on the Wix Warbird Weekly Live Show, and hopefully you'll be listening wearing your new Aero-style t-shirt. Visit warbirdradio.com/deals now and check out the all-new Wright Brothers catalog.
Hi, this is Mike Chilson, and host of the RC Scale Builder Show here on Warbird Radio. If you're interested in scale models, join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern for interviews and the latest news and events in RC Scale. The RC Scale Builder Show here on Warbird Radio.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
And welcome back here to Warbird Radio. Matt Jolly here with you. Hope you're having a good day today. Certainly a great day to be flying, I'll tell you that. A blue, clear sky today. Just severe clear here in Biloxi right now, looking out over the back bay and light winds. Man, I'm telling you what, it makes me want to go flying, but not today. It's just not going to happen today. Hopefully, someone else is getting it in today. But last 2 days have been like this. Just been tough to sit around here in the studio. But I'll tell you what, the taxes are due, so it's finishing up the receipts and all that other stuff. Man, oh man, I know it's October, but we had a lot going on this year. Filed the old extension. Now I'm dreading. This is pilot weather, Dan. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, this is the best weather of the year. And here I am counting receipts that I should have put together in April, but we had a cross-country move and a new baby. I'm telling you, it just wasn't in the cards. So anyway, now I'm doing this. But I have a trip at the end of the month. I'm looking forward to it. Gonna go flying for a while and enjoy that. So anyway, back to your book. You know, we talked about this. You said really what is driving you to do this, and you mentioned this right off the bat, is that there wasn't anything to read from the other side. But I'm guessing you really maybe identify with these guys in some way or the other, that really keeps this you know, in the front of your mind, that it's a real passion of yours. What is that?
I think what struck me was that, you know, when I was younger, my dad talked about flying. He didn't talk about his experience in the concentration camp as much, or, you know, the torture and things that he endured. But when he talked about flying a B-29, his face would, you know, shine, and he would smile, and his eyes would focus on a point near the horizon, and he would talk about it, and I just thought, my dad really liked to fly. And he said when he was a youngster, he looked up and saw these biplanes flying overhead, and he's, you know, over this rural Iowa town, and he said, I want to fly someday. His dream of flight that I'd heard since I was a kid. When I interview these Japanese pilots, lo and behold, they all talk about being little kids and looking up at the sky and dreaming of becoming a pilot someday. And they talked about flying planes. One of them said, I want to grow up and I want to kill Americans in dogfights. They all said, I want to fly around like these, you know, these pilots. And Mr. Miyazaki, he saw an actual American visiting flying circus that came to Japan. And I believe from my research on the date and timing that it was the Ivan Gates Flying Circus. And he saw these American daredevils, you know, barnstorming and flying, and there was a woman wing walker. And he said to his uncle, if they can do it, if she can do it, I can do it too. And he was like 10 or 11 at the time. And I thought, that sounds like my dad. That's really similar. Wait a minute, you're not this bloodthirsty, angry, you know, kamikaze bonsai person. You're a little kid saying you want to fly someday. And when I asked him, I said, what was your first impression of Americans? He blurted out, he said, oh, well, from the flying circus I saw, they were very brave and skilled. And from a church service that he was invited to when he was younger, he goes, they sing and they give out cake and they're nice people. And so when the war broke out, one of his first impressions was, oh, no, this is not good. These aren't the people we should be fighting against. It didn't have a good feeling. But he is a trained pilot and that was his job. Right, he's a Japanese citizen, red-blooded Japanese man. So you don't second guess what your country tells you to do. You do your job, and he gives the best of his ability. But he had no anger or rancor or resentment towards the U.S. for anything that happened during the war.
You know, which one of these interviews stands out to you the most, Dan? There's always one that you know, you listen to it when you're there, and maybe. You know, maybe you don't even hear what he's saying when you're there, and you go back home and you review your notes and you say, man, just listen to this. Is there one that just still sticks with you to this day?
Boy, it's really hard, but it has been Mr. Harada. You know, I went to Midway with him. We went to Hawaii and Midway together, and interviewed him there again, and interviewed him in his home for an entire day. And I have it on, you know, audio. And I listen to it, and I pick up new things sometimes. But just his honesty and his recollection and his forthcoming, his personality just showed through as such a warm, honest person. And at one point, he was talking about entering the city of Nanking after the Panay incident. And as you know, that was when the Japanese army was going crazy in the city of Nanking. And there was really complicated issues involved in that incident. That people tend to oversimplify. But Mr. Harada was telling me that he and one of the fellow pilots went into the city because it was his custom to try to see where his bombs had landed. as part of his job was to bust open the gates, those big 30-foot, you know, massive gates that are in Yankee. My wife and I went to go see those for ourselves a few years ago. That's part of my philosophy, is to interview the pilots and then go to the places where they fought. So I've been to Iwo and Saipan and Truck Lagoon and Rabaul and all these places. When I interview them, they talk about Iwo Jima. I said, I've been there. And so Mr. Harada was saying, when I drop bombs on a place, I always try to, when the line moves forward in the front lines, I try to get over there and see, was I to the left, was I to the right, was I too far, you know, to adjust my aim. So him and his buddy went into Nanking. They got trucks. The land got the newly captured airfield. They took trucks into Nanking. And he said he was just shocked at what he was witnessing. And I was surprised he was telling me this. Because the Japanese today, they tend to hush-hush that and keep it kind of on the down low. They don't like to talk about it. And there's even some factions in Japan are saying it didn't happen. So I paused the digital recorder and I said, Harada-san, as I promised you, anything you tell me is going in my book. I don't edit what you say. I don't change what you say. I have no political agenda. I'm not trying to make you guys out to be the good guys or the bad guys. And I said, are you sure you want to tell me what you saw in Yanking? And he looked at me and he said, I saw it. Because there are people today who say it didn't happen. He pointed his eyes and he goes, I saw it with my own eyes. I smelled it. You can start. So I hit the record button again, and he talked about it. And it was, my jaw dropped. And it was the shame he had on his face. And he said, those people were doing something horrible. And we could have stopped them. Because I felt nauseous and sick to my stomach. And at one point, you know, they're on this wharf, and these Chinese prisoners are brought in, you know, in trucks. And they're wearing regular civilian clothes. And Mr. Harada asked one of these army guys, they're chopping their heads off, they're kicking them into the water, they're praying, and then it's mayhem. And Mr. Harada says, how do you know, why are you killing these guys? And this officer says, well, they're called the Red Unit. You know, they're spies. They're not wearing uniforms and such and such. And Harada says, but how do you know? He says, well, they're here. You know, they're combatants. They didn't care. And so this officer hands Mr. Harada this sword, and it's slightly bent, and it's got this buttery, you know, grease and blood on it. And Mr. Harada turned away. You know, he said, I felt sick and ashamed. And, of course, the officer laughed and called him, you know, some names. And so they got out of there. And he said that really scarred him and stuck with him on what human beings are capable of doing to each other. And I think it's a greater thing. It's not just, oh, the Japanese were bad back then. I think it shows we as human beings, we're all capable of really horrible things. But I was really grateful that he shared that.
It's interesting that you bring that up. You bring that up and you talk about that from a pilot's perspective. We had the story of a man here that... just it, every time I replay that story and I hear the line when he says Mr. Casty's the gentleman I'm talking about, and he was an A-20 pilot, and he said himself, he said, you know, I went through the entire war and I never saw a body, never saw a dead body, but he said I had 11 roommates throughout my time there. That line alone really, I think, sums it up. But for Mr. Harada to go there, which is sort of not like most American pilots, to go back and see what his handiwork had dealt out on the ground, I think that's unique. I think that's really, really unique. I find that very interesting that he went back there and had that perspective. You know, both, I think, U.S. aviators... And as you've described now, Japanese aviators had that sort of perspective on the war, that for them it was a job. They were flying an airplane. They pushed a button, something fell, and what happened on the ground was far and away removed from the fight that they were in. And so it's interesting that he went back. Did you discover that among a lot of the pilots, or was it just Mr. Harada that went back?
that's a great point, is that, you know, I've interviewed 97 Japanese and Navy veterans to date. And at first I was trying to group them into categories. And I tried by battle or, you know, by incident or by service. And I found that the Navy veterans and Army veterans were so different on their experiences and the way they talked and what, you know, what they saw, witnessed. I just couldn't put them together. And so then actually the Navy shipboard guys and then the pilots were actually, again, so different the way they were trained and taught. So I've broken it down to different categories. And this first book is the Naval Pilot. And then my next book is going to be about an Iwo Jima survivor, the Naval Radio Man, who was sent to Iwo in the summer of 1944, was wounded, captured, and sent to Virginia as a POW after the war, and his experiences and his opinions about wanting to live and trying to ignore that military code to kill yourself and refusing to kill himself. And his story is just fascinating. And I'm working on his story. But I've also got a book on Army soldiers coming out, on some men who witnessed atrocities in China, and then some submariners. I've interviewed one of the men who was aboard the submarine I-58 that sunk the Indianapolis in that famous incident. I've seen in the movie Jaws, where the Americans are all, you know, left to be eaten by sharks.
Right.
But so I've had to break these experiences up into the books to make them easier to read and follow. But I definitely got the impression that the naval aviators were on ships or in bases, and for the most part had nice, clean places to sleep, good food to eat, to drink soda pop, and had a much nicer life than, you know, the guys who were stationed on a little island or, you know, the guys who were off in the front lines. So for the most part, the naval aviators are friendlier to American people, more jovial, have better, a little more positive experiences than the infantry guy on the ground in Guadalcanal, for example. But there was one incident that Mr. Harada mentioned that I wanted to bring out, and this kind of bothered me. As he was in the Battle of Guadalcanal, and they were trying to escort their transports, at the same time attacking our transports that were all racing to reinforce the island. And he said at one point they were low on gas, and they had to turn around and they had to leave. And there was a Japanese transport sinking in the water, and the water was dotted with hundreds and hundreds of heads of people floating around. It looked like coconuts. And so he looked back and he could see the American fighter pilots diving on these, you know, these guys swimming in the water and shooting them up. And, you know, his face was twisted and he felt really, he just looked so urgent. He said, I couldn't protect them. And he said, I felt so guilty that they were being murdered in the water. Mm. And I couldn't do anything because I was out of gas. And then he turned around and said, why did your people do that? Why did your people murder innocent guys floating in the water? It wasn't like they were 100 yards from the beach. These are guys like, you know, miles and miles from Guadalcanal with no hope of ever getting there. So in his mind, he thought, okay, these guys are now innocent. Don't shoot them up. Don't attack them. He himself was in the same position in Midway when all the aircraft carriers were sunk and he had to do a water landing, and he floated in the water for 12 hours. And he had that helpless feeling of being totally alone. And I think when he saw the guys in Guadalcanal getting machine gunned, it really hit home to him how helpless we are as people. And that once you're away from your aircraft and away from your ship, you're no longer a combatant, and we become fellow human beings again. That's what he told me. That's his opinion about that.
You know, it's interesting that You would bring up a story like that, Dan, because I was going to say, in closing, after talking about all of this in regards to Nanking, and I've heard it said by, well, not one, but several Vietnam veterans. They said the most evil thing is about an 18-year-old American boy in combat sometimes. That we are not immune to that, as you discussed there. And I think that... good for him for bringing that up. And, of course, there's no answer to that question. And I know he knows that. There's no answer to that question. It is reflective of what war is, I think. It's a terrible thing. We don't want to glorify it. We hope that by bringing up these stories and by discussing this, the history will not have to be repeated, and B, the men who fought this this terrible battle will not be forgotten, and that their sacrifices will be remembered, because it is such a terrible thing to have to go through, and unspeakable atrocities. Something we hope the world never has to see again. And by bringing this up, we hope that we can learn from this. Dan, your book is available right now on your website there at historicalconsulting.com. The title is The Last Zero Fighter. There's one of your other books is up there as well. These new ones, I hope you'll come back and discuss them with us when they're completed. My hat's off to you for telling these stories of the Last Zero Fighter. What do you want folks to know in closing as we wrap things up for this show,
Dan? I guess my closing comment would have to be that there are people today who still believe that the Kamikaze were locked into their cockpits or drugged up or somehow welded into their cockpits or chained to their, joysticks. And I guess I wanted to tell people that from what I've experienced and what I've learned from meeting these guys was that they're motivated by trying to protect their country, protect their comrades, and by their devotion to duty, and not by anger and hatred, and that they weren't crazy, maniacal people. They were desperate, and they were trying to do what they thought would save lives.
Well, I think that's a great comment there. We do have one question that came in when we announced that you're going to be on the show this week, Dan, and this is an interesting question, I think. While you were over there, did you experience or take away anything from the youth of Japan? I'm a docent at the Air Force Museum. And oftentimes we'll see young Japanese people come through who have no idea about the attack at Pearl Harbor. What was your experience? This is from Robert.
It's true. It's true. The Japanese do not teach World War II history in their schools. They just don't do it. And when they get into junior high school, the history books that I have physically seen myself will have one or two pages max with a picture of the A-bomb going off and then a picture of the surrender on the deck of the Missouri. And there'll be basically no background, no information, just there was a war, we lost, isn't it sad? And it really bothers me that the young people of today, anyone under 30 basically has no idea that they attacked Pearl Harbor and all the things that their country caused, all the hardship and heartache, economic ruin, and loss of life that Japan caused through their aggression is basically unknown to the young people in Japan today.
Well, again, the same can be said from the U.S. perspective. If you read U.S. history books today, very little on World War II. And, of course, the teachers say it's because they don't have time to teach that portion of history. And, we've talked to a lot of school teachers. In fact, one of my favorite stories is from Dutch van Kirk, the navigator on the Enola Gay, who said he was introduced once by the head of a history department at a high school who got everything correct. She said, this is... Mr. Dutch van Kirk, he was the navigator on the Enola Gay, dropped the first atomic bomb. Please welcome World War XI veteran Dutch van Kirk.
Oh!
So, my point being, I don't think we're immune to that here either. I mean, Americans don't know their history, but it is hard to think that a group of Japanese tourists could tour the Air Force Museum and not have any idea about Pearl Harbor. I mean, not even, they see the airplanes there, they see the display and the storyboard on that, and find it hard to believe they don't accept that really happened. So interesting that you experienced that as well, Dan. Thanks for coming back. If you have questions for Dan, folks, you can find him there at historicalconsulting.com. I'm guessing that the email is probably the best way to reach you there, Dan, and it's all over your website, historicalconsulting.com. Dan King, thanks for being here this morning. It's been a real pleasure having you. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you real soon, Dan. Thanks again. Dan King, everybody, he's been our guest this week, and I do appreciate each and every one of you for hanging out with us. Now, don't forget, if you have a story idea, if you have something that you want to ask one of our guests, you can always send me an email. It's just matt@warbirdradio.com. You can find out more information about what's coming up right there at warbirdradio.com as well. We have some great shows coming up for you later this week. One of them that our good friend Chris Henry is working on Leave it to Chris to find the beautiful ladies. He's talking with one of the USO girls who toured with Bob Hope and Danny Kaye. And he said, she's just as gorgeous today as she was back then. She was at one point, the Chiquita Banana Girl. And is still supporting our troops even today in her 90s. And her tie to Warbird Rescue is going to be pretty incredible. And we'll have that story for you later this week. Zane Adams also working on another great show. Mike Chilson, who has been on vacation for most of the summer, will be back as well with an all-new RC Scale Builder show. So some fun stuff. Listen, there's fly-ins galore this weekend, not only here in Mississippi, but in Alabama, Louisiana, even a big steerman fly-in going on here in Mississippi, I believe. I'm taking part in not the steerman fly-in, but another one with our friend Tony, who is a listener to this station. He's invited me over there, so I'm flying east this weekend. I'd love to hear where you're going. This is fly-in season, and I hope to see some of you there and abouts at some of these other fly-ins. But also, if you are headed to the Monroe, North Carolina Air Show, it's coming up a week earlier. You know, the city has taken this show over. This year, it is not Warriors and Warbirds. It is a new show by the city. I'm not sure what they're calling it yet. We're going to try and have them on. But I'll be there. Still going to go out there and support Warriors and Warbirds. They have a display area set up, and we're going to take the new, hopefully, Warbird radio airplane out there. So I know how it happened. I can't believe it happened. But there's going to be a new bird in the stable here pretty soon. So hard to believe, but I don't know what I'm doing with two airplanes. But anyway, we'll see how this works out. But another adventure on tap at the end of the month, heading to Mississippi from Georgia via North Carolina. So figure that one out. I don't know how this is happening. And I don't know how every airplane I've managed to acquire comes from Georgia. But we'll figure that one out too. Listen, thanks for being here. Be sure and thank a veteran if you see one. Let them know you appreciate it. And send me an email, matt@warbirdradio.com. Love to hear from you. Listener line always open, 478-787-4768. Love hearing from you. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thanks again, folks. We'll talk to you next week.